Okay, why don't we gather? So my pleasure to introduce Julia Scuccione, who's at UCSF now and had been at Washington, and had worked on a lot of the early modeling stuff and some fiber things, and is now doing finite element analysis related to LV aneurysm. So look forward to his talk. Thanks for being here, Julia.
Dr. Duncan, I want to thank all the organizers for the opportunity to talk and attend the very good talks at this workshop for picking such a great location. And I want to commend IPAM for the great organization of this workshop. I think my presentation is going to be a little different. I have a different interpretation of the word workshop. I'm just going to focus on one study, but it's a culmination of about 20 years of modeling, so I have plenty of previous studies to refer to. This study was recently published in the American Journal of Physiology. If you have any trouble getting the a PDF, my email is on the handout. Send an email. Be happy to get that to you. Joe Walker was a PhD student in the joint Berkeley UCSF graduate bioengineering program. He's now working at Guidant in Minnesota, but he was a real pleasure to work with. Very mature guy, never needed any pep talks or anything like that. So, after seeing the preliminary program, I thought that this would be, I was asked to talk about tissue properties and mechanics, but I thought that this would be a good study to fit within the program. And that's because it applies a number of the things that have been talked about in detail in previous presentations. We use a sheet model of left ventricular aneurysm, a very reproducible model that allows us to measure a lot of things that you couldn't in volunteers. using Dr. Prince's terminology from his talk yesterday, we use conventional tagged MRI. Excuse me, and thanks to Elliot McVeigh, Mike Gutman, and Chengis Oster, we're able to do a fully three-dimensional strain analysis that corrects for the through-plane motion. With the help of Ed Hsu, who was at Duke and is now at University of Utah, we would ship our sheet parts to him, and he would do the MRDTI to give us the very important high-resolution muscle fiber orientation and distribution throughout the left ventricle. Of course, I'm going to talk about finite element modeling, and I thought Alistair gave a great talk yesterday, but he really didn't explain the finite element method, and I think it's fantastic that seems to be a buzzword at this workshop, but I would be very surprised if you really know the finite element method, its theoretical basis. And the most important thing is you need a very sophisticated or unique unconventional finite element method to develop realistic models of a beating left ventricle. Tissue properties are typically measured by direct mechanical testing, so I will provide an example of that. And then if you were here for Alistair's talk yesterday, about 24 hours ago, you're probably wondering, well, you know, this is just a repeat. Fortunately, he didn't talk about systolic and mature properties, so I have something to talk about. Now, I thought Dr. Prince gave a great presentation, and you can just see that he's a very good teacher. He said he was going to make four important points, and he had them, you know, distributed nicely throughout his talk, and he warned you when they were coming up. And I'm going to, that seemed like a lot of work, so with the next two slides, I'm going to try to make four important points. This isn't the outline of my talk, it's just what's in there, contents. So I'm going to make four important points, and then I'm going to give you the outline. Okay, the first point that I want to make involves some definitions of two branches of mechanics. And I don't want the MRI or physics people, the experimentalists, to take this the wrong way, because I'm your greatest fan, people that can get detailed anatomy, muscle fiber orientation, and measure deformation and function. You just make my job that much easier. And I just want to explain that after making those measurements, we can, through mathematical modeling, we can add value to those measurements. But really, with MRI and medical imaging, you're only able to measure or study the kinematics of the heart. You're not able to measure the forces responsible for the motion or deformation. That's, if you are, then you're doing a kinetics analysis. And this is used in our society to build bridges and airplanes. And I think you feel a lot more comfortable crossing a bridge or flying an airplane where the analysis of the forces responsible for the deformation were taken into account. Similarly, if you want to diagnose a patient identify their risk for developing heart failure after myocardial infarction, or pick a therapy for their heart disease, I would hope that you would want to base those decisions on more than just kinematics, but also the forces responsible for the deformation. Okay, so that's the first one. Alistair already made this next point that I'm sure the experimentalists, the physicists, MRI experts would measure the force if they could, if there was a reliable technique for accurately measuring forces in the intact heart wall, but at present there isn't. That would be a great research area or accomplishment if it was possible. And then Alistair and all the people that I've trained with, in particular Andrew McCullough, Peter Hunter, they really emphasize the importance of validating these models. If you want to use them in clinical applications, there's no way a clinician's going to have any confidence in your model unless you have validated it with appropriate measurements. And if you can't, you want to predict wall stress, which is related to myocardial oxygen consumption, regional coronary blood flow, growth, hypertrophy, remodeling. You want to predict that with mathematical modeling, but you can't directly verify it with experimental measurements. So the alternative is to predict the strain distribution that can be measured, as Elliot showed just earlier, make predictions with your mathematical model, and then compare them with the experimental strain measurements. So it's not a direct validation. Now, I work with a clinician every day, a cardiac surgeon, Mark Ratcliffe, at the San Francisco VA Medical Center, and he was trained at Johns Hopkins and UPenn, and so he's a firm believer in the pressure volume loop analysis. And so he reminded me, I treat the stress distribution as like a holy grail, but he really reminded me that even more important is ventricular function. And he has convinced me that ejection fraction is really not a very good measure of ventricular function, at least in the case of surgical remodeling, where you're significantly changing end-diastolic volume. Because ejection fraction is stroke volume divided by and diastolic volume. So you can reduce stroke volume, but if you decrease end diastolic volume even more, then it looks like you're improving ejection fraction. But in the Starling relationship, stroke volume versus end diastolic pressure, that will, the ventricular function curve, you'll see what is really happening. And then, as far as it being more important than ventricular wall stress, Alistair brought up the Batista procedure, where the idea is to reduce the size of a dilated failing heart. If ventricular wall stress is so important, you know, just reduce it down to a point. Is that going to work? No. Cardiac output, the flow of blood out of the heart per unit time, that's the real. Major factor as far as the patient's health after operation. Okay, now the outline. First, I'm going to describe the finite element method, describe some of the special features of the finite element method that we use at UCSF. And then I was asked to talk about tissue properties. I'm going to give you some details, focus not so much on diastolic stress-strain relationships, because Alistair did a very good job yesterday, but focus more on the systolic stress-strain relationships for constitutive modeling. I don't know if only having five key parameters is something to brag about. On the one hand, Alistair pointed out that it takes days to do a formal optimization of the four passive material properties, so if you're going to do systolic, you want to add as few additional parameters as possible, but the bottom line is we want to take as little time in determining material properties. And by comparing it with the experimental data that can be measured so elegantly using MRI, we can determine the utility of the model, how accurate it is. And basically, we do a very similar approach to what Alistair described yesterday of backing out on material properties for measurements of left ventricular pressure, boundary conditions, regional 3D strain, using the finite element method. And in this animal model of myocardial infarction. Then I'm going to conclude with future plans, which if we're successful, I think we're going to make everybody in this room very happy. Okay, so special features are the details of our finite element method, as described by Kevin Costa, Peter Hunter, Andrew McCulloch in this paper. It's actually a two-part paper. The second part deals with these ellipsoidal curvilinear prolate spheroidal coordinates. And this slide shows the relationship between the prolate spheroidal coordinates, lambda, the transmural coordinate, mu, the longitudinal coordinate, and theta, the circumferential coordinate, in relation to the typical rectangular Cartesian coordinates. And D is the focal length. And the governing equations were derived in this curvilinear coordinate system, and it allows you to model the geometry, left ventricular geometry, and the boundary conditions very efficiently. For example, with just one finite element shown here. You can also use spherical or cylindrical coordinates, and that's determined by the, or you can create a spherical or cylindrical model by changing the focal length. An infinite focal length gives you a cylinder. Focal length d equal to zero gives you a sphere. Now, if you want to account for a realistic variation in wall thickness from the base down to the apex, as I'll show in the next slide, then you would refine your mesh into numerous elements along the longitude. And the inter-element connection points are called nodes in the finite element method. So here we got two coordinate systems, rectangular Cartesian coordinates, prolate spheroidal coordinates. Another special feature of our finite element method is we have a separate coordinate system for the muscle fiber and sheet coordinate system. So to add a little color to my presentation, I'm using a figure from this paper in the Journal of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery, in which we sent normal sheep hearts with left ventricular aneurysm, and sheep hearts that had left ventricular aneurysm had been treated surgically in the most simple manner. The aneurysm was plicated, the aneurysm was gathered, and suture was run through it so that the blood couldn't enter the aneurysm. This is something that doesn't need cardiopulmonary bypass. And why did we do this? Well, there's a cardiac surgeon, he's actually here at UCLA, Gerald Buckberg, and he proposed that surgical treatments that are effective because they reorient the muscle fibers, change the muscle fiber distribution in such a way that the function, postoperative function, is optimal. And that assumes that if you have a myocardial infarction or a failing heart, that the muscle fiber orientation is abnormal. So if you go in and get this paper, you'll find that, at least in our hands and with Ed Su's help and the MRDTI, the muscle fiber distribution from normal and sheep hearts with left ventricular aneurysm were not significantly different. And when you perform this, this surgery that greatly changes the left ventricular geometry, the only differences in muscle fiber orientation are, not surprisingly, very close to where the geometry was changed the most, right, where the neck of the aneurysm, or the border zone of the aneurysm. But anyway, with the finite element method, with MRI, you can get the strain maps. If you know the muscle fiber orientation, you can get these nice color maps showing the strain distribution in the left ventricle. And with the finite element method, we'd like to be able to predict and produce nice color maps of stress, for example, in the muscle fiber orientation. So first I'd like to, there's discussion about what strain formulation you should use. And really, there are many different strain tensors that you could cook up, many more so than stress. There are just three measures of stress. And one of them is Cauchy stress, or force per unit area in the deformed or current state. And what you may not know is the state of stress at a point is completely defined by six components of the stress tensor. And I just want to use, if you want to incorporate kinetics in your research lab, this book, First Course in Continuum Mechanics, Fung is one of my mentors at UCSD. This is a very excellent starting point. Continuum mechanics is really just applied mathematics. So if you have a good mathematics background, you should be able to pick this up quite readily. But there's a notation. Stress is a tensor. Why is it a tensor? Well, it depends on two vectors. One vector is the force vector, the direction in which the force is acting. The other vector defines this surface, the normal to the surface on which you want to compute the stress. And the notation, typical notation, is the first index defines the surface. So this is the positive x2 face here on the right. And then the second index designates the direction. So this normal stress is on the two face acting in the positive 2 direction. This is a shear stress on the positive 2 face acting in the positive 3 direction. And this is the tau 2 1, the shear stress on the positive X2 phase acting in the X1 direction. And then typically for normal stress, natural assumption is that it's tensile or positive. So tensile stress on the negative X2 face is pointing in the negative X2 direction, and on the negative X2 face, the positive sense for tau 21 is acting in the negative X1 direction, and the positive sense for tau 23 on the negative X2 face is acting in the negative X3 direction. And these stresses, the stresses acting in the X1 direction aren't shown just for clarity, otherwise we'd have too many arrows, it would get confusing. But these stresses, tensile stresses, tend to produce normal strains, increase the dimensions of this cube in the X1, X2, and X3 directions, and the shear stresses tend to turn this nice cube into a parallelogram. Shear strain is a simplified description, is a change in the angle, the vertices of these corners of the cube from 90 degrees to some angle that differs from 90 degrees. Okay, so we want to solve for stresses using the finite element method. So what are the governing equations? Well, although the heart is dynamic, it's a pump, to simplify things, we use a quasi-static analysis. So we consider equilibrium between the surface tractions, the pressure on the endocardial surface, and the potential energy stored in the elastic muscle. Consider that as equilibrium. Accelerations are zero, F is equal, the center forces are equal to zero at each time point. And there are two particularly important time points, and that's end diastole, end of filling, end systole, end of ejection. So the equilibrium equations, differential equilibrium equations, are shown here. The stresses with components in the X1 direction, X2 direction, X3 direction, and their spatial variation need to satisfy these equations if we have sum of forces is equal to zero and the acceleration of the body is zero. Now, Einstein proposed a summation convention to greatly reduce the number of equations. Well, this is another way to write these three equations. If whenever you have the same index, we have J repeated here, that implies a sum of J, and you insert 1, then 2, then 3, replace J with those two indices, and then if we replace I with 1, we have this equation, I with 2, we have this equation, I with 3, we have this equation, and you may notice a discrepancy here, and that's because the stress tensor is symmetric. Tau 1,2 is equal to tau 2,1, tau 1,3 is equal to tau 1,3, tau 2,3 is equal to tau 3,2. Now, you've heard, I've been here since Monday, so I know what's been mentioned, but perhaps some of you are here just today. Anyway, there's been some discussion, or mention, unfortunately for me, about Lagrangian and Eulerian. And this is the Eulerian description of the differential equations of equilibrium. This is a Lagrangian description, and it's a description for curvilinear coordinates. So rather than a partial derivative, we have what's called a covariant derivative. Now the quantity inside the parentheses. So this is Cauchy stress, force per unit area in the deformed configuration. First Biola-Kirchhoff stress is force per area, and the area is the reference configuration. And this term P is the third stress tensor, the second Biola-Kirchhoff stress tensor. The physical meaning, some continuum textbooks say there is no physical meaning. Some people say there is, but I'm not going to get into it. But you can relate the second Biola-Kirchhoff stress tensor to the first Biola-Kirchhoff stress tensor by the deformation gradient. And I was pleased that two of the talks yesterday actually defined the deformation gradient tensor, which is purely a kinematic measure. So what's different in our finite element method is rather than looking at spatial derivatives of the unformed or the deformed coordinate with respect to the unformed coordinate, we actually have the deformed coordinate, the geometric coordinate, like the prolate spheroidal coordinate, and its spatial variation with respect to undeformed coordinates referred to the fiber coordinate system. So we have geometric coordinates in the deformed state, fiber coordinates in the undeformed state. Okay, so these are differential equations of equilibrium, Eulerian, Lagrangian. Now, really the finite element method, if you just want a one sentence definition, it's an approximate, it's a mathematical method or tool for solving partial differential equations approximately. So it's not just for mechanics, it'll work for electromagnetics, any heat equation, anything that has a partial differential equation describing the distribution of these dependent variables within some boundary. But you, if you were modeling the left ventricle as a sphere or a cylinder, and there have been many papers published that do that, then you assume that the stress and strain just vary in one direction. From endocardium to epicardium. That way you can, then these partial differential equations reduce to just ordinary differential equation, and you can integrate those using Simpson's rule or Gaussian quadrature. So similarly with the partial differential equations, we'd like to convert these into an integral equation. And that equation, T equation, is the basis for just about every solid mechanic finite element analysis method or code that I know of is the principle of virtual work. So here on the right-hand side, S are the surface tractions. And for the left ventricle, this is, we can, if we're modeling diastole, this is end-diastolic pressure. And the work done by the surface tractions on the surfaces, we typically say epicardial pressure is zero. The work is the product of that surface traction with these virtual displacements. But that's how the name virtual, principle of virtual work comes about. But these are what we're going to solve with the finite element method. We're going to have some mesh with these certain distribution of elements and inter-element connection points nodes. We want to solve for the deformed or the displacements of those nodes under mechanical equilibrium. So we have an area integral on the surfaces of our finite element model of the left ventricle. And then this is essentially the potential energy stored within between the boundaries. So we have the second Piola-Kirchhoff stress tensor, this deformation gradient tensor, and again, the virtual displacements, and here we have the, rather than a partial derivative, because we use curvilinear coordinates, we've got a covariant derivative. So the covariant derivative in a curvilinear coordinate system differs from partial derivatives by this correction term, the Christoffel symbol. And they're quite complicated, especially for prolate spheroidal coordinates, and they're in the appendix of this paper. Why do we need a correction? well, in continuum mechanics, and if you're going to use a linear coordinate system or a choice between coordinate systems, you'd like to have tensor equations, which are going to hold for any coordinate system. So each term in these equations have to be tensors. And these partial derivatives are not necessarily tensors. They are in a rectangular Cartesian coordinate system, but you need a correction for a curvilinear coordinate system. Okay, so principle of virtual work is the basis for finite element method of solid mechanics. Now, this will hold for any material. We haven't specified, made this specific to myocardium. How do we do that? Well, we're going to replace the second Piola-Kirchhoff stress tensor with a constituent relation, a stress-strain relationship, so that we have the surface traction as an input, left ventricular pressure, and then the only unknown we have are the virtual displacements, the new nodal Prolet-Spheroidal coordinates, and we can solve for those. So those are the only unknowns, the deformed Prolet-Spheroidal nodal coordinates. So the next few slides, we're going to talk about constitutive relations for monocardium.
Yes. So in a model like this, you don't take into account the fibers, like forces from the fibers, like the forces from the fibers. Everything comes from the surface, like pressure.
Right. No, in the constituent relation.
Moved in there, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good point. So, are there any commercial software packages that you can? I'm encouraging you to use the finite element method. I'm encouraging you to use large deformation and anisotropy. How are you going to do that? Well, hopefully Andrew McCulloch is going to talk this afternoon. He has a website where you can download this this software. And why is this software so valuable? Just from what Dimitri has suggested, how are you going to incorporate active contraction? You can do some tricks in Abacus or Ansys or these commercial packages to produce fibers and springs and stuff like that, hit the anisotropy. But how are you going to model systolic contraction by adding internal stresses? You need to get it. You need to know that code and know exactly where to add these. It's actually pretty straightforward, but you need the source code and be able to go into the code and add the active stress. Okay, so Alistair showed this equation yesterday, or at least a version of it, I think. So basically you're doing a curve fit. You're assuming that the myocardium is hyperelastic so that you can use a strain energy function. You differentiate the strain energy function to get stresses. If you want the fiber stress, P11, you differentiate your strain energy function with respect to fiber strain, E11. And Alistair talked about enforcing incompressibility, the fact that during the deformation, the volume of your finite elements are preserved. Soft tissue is 80% water. It's approximately incompressible. How do you do that? Alistair said that one way is to make sure that the determinant of the deformation gradient tensor is equal to 1. Another way is to add a Lagrange multiplier in a mathematical sense, so that you enforce the deformation to satisfy incompressibility. So that this little p will start to run out of parameters. The method's so complicated, or variables. This is hydrostatic pressure, but again, it doesn't really have any physical meaning. It's a Lagrangian multiplier, so that the unknowns, the nodal displacements, or the new Prolet-Spheroidal coordinates of our nodes, satisfy incompressibility of the wall. And this really complicates things. Often in commercial code, you'll set the Poisson's ratio, the relationship between elongation and lateral contraction, to 0.5, so that you can't actually use 0.5. You have to use something close to 0.5. like 0.45 so that your code doesn't lock up. A better approach is this Lagrangian multiplier approach. So this is an unknown that we also need to solve for. So we need to determine deformed nodal coordinates as well as hydrostatic pressure, either as a nodal variable, or we typically make it very simple and just have constant hydrostatic pressure within each element. The limitation of that is your stress and strain calculations are only going to be accurate at the center of the finite elements. And then another, the main difference or addition to what Alistair talked about yesterday is this active stress that we simply add to the diastolic stresses, so to speak, to get total or systolic stress. And if you are familiar with the muscle mechanics, cardiac or even skeletal muscle mechanics, the active stress is a function of time. The switch that turns on the contractile filament interaction, calcium, and here's peak intracellular calcium within a cardiac muscle twitch. And then L represents sarcomere. That's very important. In fact, if you can figure out a way to measure sarcomere with MRI, that would also, as well as measure forces in the intact heart, then you're really on to something. This is the Kronecker delta. It's another helpful thing as far as writing equations. It's equal to zero unless both indices have the same index. So delta 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, or 1, otherwise it's 0. Delta 1, 2, delta 1, 3, etc. So what does this do? We're only adding active stress in the muscle fiber direction. Now, if you read the abstract to this, to my presentation, you already know that's a limitation. We found out that you also need to add a percentage of this, 40%, in the 2-2 cross-fiber direction. Why? What's the justification for that? Well, the muscle fiber orientation isn't exactly, all the muscle fibers at a particular depth, a particular location, don't run exactly parallel. There is about a 15-degree splay, so to speak. So there's going to be some component in the cross-fiber direction. Okay, so we've heard a lot. This is the green strain, the Lagrangian strain, and it's determined from the metric tensor, covariant metric tensor, determined from the deformation gradient tensors, and then this is the contravariant metric tensor, which we can obtain for inversion of the covariant metric tensor. This is the form proposed by Fung for many soft tissues. We specialized it. It's the simplest form of anisotropy. It's very important to include anisotropy in your kinetics analysis, because even in the passive state, ventricular muscle is significantly stiffer in the muscle fiber direction than in the cross fiber direction. The ratio, it depends on the stretch, but it's typically a ratio of 3-1. And this is very interesting because we've heard about electrophysiology and the speed of propagation. That also has a ratio of 3-1, fastest in the muscle fiber direction. And then the diffusion, MRDTI, used to get the muscle fiber orientation, it turns out that the ratio, the muscle fiber direction to this trying to go diffuse to the semipermeable membrane, again, is 3-1. I find that very interesting. And then if we add not just active fiber stress, but cross-fiber stress, I used to think that during systole, the ratio fiber stress to cross-fiber stress during systole would increase, but apparently it also remains about 3-1. So we need to, at least as initial guesses, we need to provide some values for these four passive or diastolic material property parameters, C, B sub F, B sub T, B sub FS, And these are the parameters that we found for normal canine myocardium. And the fact that B sub F fiber stiffness is so much greater than transverse stiffness gives you an idea of this significant anisotropy ratio. And then, so we're going to solve, we're going to put this into principal virtual work, solve for nodal displacements, hydrostatic pressure. Once we found those, we can plug these in and get stress. This doesn't have any physical meaning. We can, using the deformation gradient tensor, we can convert this into Cauchy stress, which has very natural meaning, force per unit area in uniform state. Okay, so we've got four parameters for diastole. I already told you that we have five parameters, key parameters, ones that we try to determine from MRI and left ventricular pressure total. Alistair said that he's focusing on diastole, and he feels that systole is going to be very simple. Well, he's a pretty clear thinker. But if you looked at the literature on uniaxial tension development in cardiac muscle, you would think that active contraction is a lot more complicated than just passive diastolic filling. And one of the most complicated things in the literature when I started reading about it was shortening deactivation. And before I describe that, I first want to point out the phenomenon of length-dependent activation. So sarcomere length is very important independent variable for active tension development. And if you get a specimen, so this is a uniaxial test, and so you, the typical experiment, and this is championed by Hank Tekurs, who was, I think he was at Eindhoven, now he's at Calgary. You shine a laser through a rat cardiac trabeculate. It's like a little ribbon, very thin, and the angle of diffraction of the laser is proportional to the grating, essentially, the overlap of the actin myosin. So you, in real time, you can get a measure of sarcomere length. And it turns out, and this is a problem with all mechanical testing of at least muscle, that when you obtain your specimen, you damage it. And so you typically produce damage in the muscle at the two ends, where you're either putting a hook through a remnant of the mitral valve, I'm sorry, the tricuspid valve, because this typically comes to the right ventricle, or this block of tissue. You've got damage at the ends, so there's no contraction of the muscle fibers. But in that viable central portion, upon electrical stimulation, you will get contraction, but you'll get shortening in the central viable region because you're stretching the damaged areas. So this wasn't really realized until the early 80s. And so there was a lot of muscle, cardiac muscle mechanics data collected prior to that that has major artifacts in it, because when they think they have an isometric or isosarcometric contraction, they really don't. So here, these jagged curves are from a paper from Hank Tekurs' lab, I think in 1982 publication. And in rat cardiac trabeculae, at least, and when you stretch the trabeculae after stimulating it so that the sarcomere length that you measure with laser diffraction remains constant, so these are truly isosarcometric contractions, peak tension occurs very rapidly. And in rat trabeculae, it happens within 100 microseconds, and it doesn't seem, the time to peak activation doesn't seem to depend on sarcomere length. However, the value, the maximum, the magnitude of active tension depends strongly on sarcomere length. And also the duration of the relaxation phase depends strongly on sarcomere length. So this has been termed length-dependent activation. And this is something that you should include in your kinetics analysis. What's shortening deactivation? Now, if you allow the sarcomeres to shorten early in the twitch, before peak tension is achieved, and you bring it right back to the original sarcomere length, then the effect of tension development is minuscule. So here I've got the time course of sarcomere lengths initially starting at 2.14, and then there's a rapid shortening transient down to 2.04 within 10 microseconds. Anyway, it's a shortening velocity of 10 micrometers per second. And then you stretch right back up, and this is tension development, and it looks just like an isometric twitch. But if you allow shortening to occur after peak tension has been achieved, then redeveloped tension is only a fraction of what it would be if you had an isometric contraction. And the later you apply the shortening transient, the smaller redeveloped tension, the smaller the ratio of redeveloped tension to control tension, so to speak. So to incorporate this in a finite element model where you have a realistic geometry and large deformation, it will take a very long time. Is it necessary? So to test this out, we used a very simple geometry, a cylindrical model of the equatorial region of the left ventricle. And you can incorporate large deformation, anisotropy, residual stress, a lot of things, just not a realistic geometry. And we put three different models of active stress development. One was a model that could reproduce shortening deactivation as measured experimentally. You're probably familiar with the force-velocity relationship of muscle. The fact that it's a lot easier for me to bring my arm up when I'm holding a pen rather than a 10-pound weight. So the greater the load on the muscle, the slower I'm going to be able to contract that muscle and shorten the sarcomeres. So we simply we incorporated the hyperbolic relationship between force and velocity that's been measured experimentally in rat cardiac trabeculae. And then a very simple time-varying elastance model where sarcomere length depends simply on active tension depends just on instantaneous sarcomere length, a model that could reproduce the length-dependent activation but not the effect of velocity or the history dependence of active tension on sarcomere length. And we got very different predictions of sarcomere length at two in the subendocardium, subepicardium of the cylindrical model between end diastole and end systole. But the differences were least at end systole. And if we look at the transmural distribution of sarcomere length from the endocardium to the epicardium in the cylindrical model with the three different active stress formulations, the shape of the transmural sarcomere length distribution was remarkably similar. And we could get the simple elastance model, that distribution to lie right on top of the deactivation predictions if we tune down the peak intracellular calcium concentration in the elastance model. So that's what we've been doing ever since. This is only a good model of end-systole. So this is the formulation for active stress, and this is the fifth parameter that we use to fit to MRI data, Tmax. To incorporate length-dependent activation, we have a simple dose-response relationship between peak intracellular calcium concentration and active stress. This is the half-maximal calcium concentration. And here it depends on sarcomere length to reproduce a twitch. We have some simple trigonometric function. And it depends on time relative to peak tension. and the relaxation time depends linearly on sarcomere length. So there are a lot of parameters here, but we don't vary those. We only vary this Tmax parameter. And then to figure out what sarcomere length is within the finite element model, we, as long as we know Green's strain, Lagrangian strain in the muscle fiber direction, and some input for the initial reference sarcomere length distribution, we can back out sarcomere length. Is there another justification for using a time-varying elastance active tension development model in our finite element model, the beating left ventricle? Well, if we go from the one-dimensional analog, active stress sarcomere length, to a three-dimensional analysis or analogy, pressure volume, there is. So here we have these pressure volume loops filling, isovolumic contraction, ejection, isovolumic relaxation, and we have different volumes and pressures at the end of filling or the preload, and different pressures at the end of ejection, end systole, here, the afterload, so to speak. And thanks to Suga and Sagawa, at least initially at Hopkins, we know that under normal conditions, you can connect the end systolic points with a straight line. And this is referred to as the end systolic pressure volume relationship. If you do a curvilinear fit through the end diastolic portions, you get the end diastolic pressure volume relationship. And so we have an end systolic pressure volume relationship where end systolic pressure is an instantaneous function of end systolic volume. It really doesn't matter what the path that you're taking in this pressure volume plane. Okay, so why did we use SHEEP as a model, experimental model of a cardiac disease? Well, for one thing, it's very simple. It's a nice starting point if you're going to have develop a model that has regional variation in material properties, because when you tie off the left anterior descending coronary artery 40% of the distance, this isn't drawn to scale, from the apex to the base and the collateral, you're going to infarct, you're going to produce a large abnormality, 25% of left ventricular mass. And in these Dorset sheep, the coronary anatomy is remarkably consistent. So in this study by Markowitz, the standard deviation in the size of the infarction in the aneurysm was only something like 2 or 3%. So 25% of the mass plus or minus 2 or 3%. That's remarkably consistent. And we almost always see between 8 to 12 weeks after this chronic ligature a left ventricular aneurysm develops. This is not the case in dogs. I think you probably kill a lot of pigs if you tried this. There are no collaterals in the sheep. And as long as you're very careful about arrhythmias in the 15 to 30 minutes after you ligate the LAD, as long as the animal can get past that critical period, then it's you just about always get left ventricular aneurysm 8 to 12 weeks after chronic infarction. Okay, so we use Siemens scanner, and nowadays you can press a button, and well, it's not that easy, but there's some standard tagging sequence on the Siemens scanner at the San Francisco VA Medical Center. And we obtain, in order to use Elliot McVeigh's lab's software for the strain analysis, we obtain 6 long axis slices every 30 degrees around the circumference. And to get a nice finite element model with realistic geometry, we obtain short axis images every 5 millimeters between the apex and the base. And we use a limitation of in vivo analysis is you really don't, it's hard to get an unloaded configuration, and much less a stress-free configuration. But we choose the early diastolic filling configuration to define the reference configuration of our stress analysis. Okay, so, so this may look fairly normal to you, but look how thin the wall gets. Here's the aneurysm. So we've got the typical 10 to 12 millimeter wall thickness. Here's the septum, the left ventricular free wall. And then there's a transition, a sharp transition. Within 1 centimeter, as you go from base to apex, the wall thickness is going to change from 10 to 12 millimeters down to 1 to 3. So you've essentially got a membrane, no myocytes, all collagen. And so we actually had to ask Mike Gutman to send us a version of fine tags that had 4 times as many points for defining the endocardial and epicardial contour. So we create a finite element mesh with 3 distinct sets of material properties. We have the aneurysm, a remote region with a normal wall thickness, and then the border zone, which is a transition. And we base this most simply just on wall thickness, where the center of this transition from the normal wall thickness to the 1 to 3 millimeter thickness. Now, unfortunately, when part of the left ventricle is so thin, you're not going to get enough signal to do tagging or measure nice Lagrangian strain. So to get material properties of the aneurysm, we do the traditional mechanical testing. And I think this is the only time when, apart from tissue engineered specimens, biaxial testing is really a two-dimensional test, and you need a two-dimensional structure. The left ventricle, normal left ventricular wall is a complicated three-dimensional structure. To obtain a two-dimensional specimen, you're going to seriously damage it, or at least change the material properties. But an aneurysm that doesn't have any myocytes, pure collagen, it's a two-dimensional structure, and we can do a pretty good job of determining material properties in a nice direct manner where we know what the forces are. We can directly measure those forces with force transducers, attach some markers to the surface. We typically use the endocardial surface and track them with a digital camera. We can compute strain, measure force, normalized by cross-sectional area, get stress, and produce these nonlinear stress-strain relationships. Now, the aneurysm without the myocytes is not nearly as anisotropic as normal myocardium, and we typically refer the stresses, so we have stress versus Lagrangian strain in the circumferential direction and longitudinal direction, so we just work hard just to keep track of the specimen, its orientation within the left ventricle, so we're measuring strain in the circumferential direction and the longitudinal direction. We really don't have any muscle fibers to try and dictate the stretching protocol. But anyway, we find that it's a little bit stiffer in the circumferential direction than in the longitudinal direction, but the anisotropy ratio is nothing like myocardium.
Joyce, sorry.
Yes.
Could you recap the 5 parameters?
4 parameters in the strain energy function and Tmax.
And do you get all 5 out of this testing?
No.
No.
There's no contraction in this.
Right. So you get the 4. Or
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And then you assume something for the fifth in the model. I mean, so you've got three different models. Each has different assumptions on the five in the three regions, right?
We have no contraction in the aneurysm. We're going to assume that in the next slide I'll show you how we relate remote border zone active contraction to remote. But we have different diastolic material properties in the aneurysm determined from biaxial testing from the border zone in the remote region, and we use the MRI as kind of a trial and error iteration to get the material properties of the non-infarcted regions. Okay, so how do we determine material properties in the border zone and relate them to the remote region? Or should they have the same material properties? And here's another example of when kinetics is very more helpful in determining mechanisms than pure kinematic analysis. So when I was at Washington University, there's a cardiac surgeon, Michael Pask, that's a real champion of the finite element method and MR tagging. And they found, using MR tagging, that the border zone behaves abnormally compared to the remote region, even though the perfusion blood flow seems to be normal. And it's during the isovolumic contraction phase, aren't you glad I showed the PV loops now, where this abnormality shows up. So in the border zone, and they measured circumferential deformation in both the anterior and posterior border zone, they found stretching muscle fibers during isovolumic contraction, whereas in the remote region, there's normal shortening and, of course, stretching in the aneurysm during this pressure development phase. And they said, okay, so it's one of two things, this abnormality. Either there's a stress concentration, the load on these border zone muscle fibers is so high that they can't shorten, or their contractility, their ability to contract is depressed. So there's the material properties are different from the remote region, their contractility. So we created a finite element model of this she part with left ventricular aneurysm, and we assign the same contractile properties to the border zone and the remote region, and predicted strain in the muscle fiber direction in these different regions during isovolumic contraction. And we found that we didn't get any stretching in the border zone muscle fibers. We actually got shortening in the anterior border zone. So this suggests that this mechanism is not just a stress concentration or due to the thinning of the border zone. It's kind of a triangular shape when you look at the wall thickness. So how much would we need to decrease contractility in the border zone to get the same amount of fiber strain as measured with TAG MRI? And it turns out that it's 50% reduction. So the Tmax that we use in the border zone is only half of that we use in the remote regions. And why is this important to surgeons? Well, there's still some debate as to what is the best treatment of left ventricular aneurysm. Do you use a patch? Do you on cardiopulmonary bypass? Do you simply plicate the aneurysm? There's some debate because there hasn't been a kinetics analysis. But they assume that the border zone has normally contracting muscle fibers, and that as long as they can reduce stress on the border zone, it'll start contracting normally. This kinetics analysis suggests that that's not the case. and that the border zone fibers are significantly damaged, their contractile ability. Okay, so this slide shows strain computed from the conventional tagged MRI, Mike Gutman's fine tags program, Chengis's, Ozturk's TTT analysis that takes into account through plane motion. And here's a color map. This is circumferential strain, mid wall. Minus 0.2 is dark blue, as we see in the remote regions, and zero is like green, and a little bit of stretching in the border zone in yellow, and because the aneurysm is so thin, we don't get any strain measurement there. And these are predictions of the circumferential strain, regional strain, from the finite element model after we have in a trial and error fashion, fit this capital C to end-diastolic volume measurement versus end-diastolic pressure, an initial value of T max to the end-systolic volume versus the measured end-systolic pressure, and then the exponential parameters, V sub F, V sub T, V sub FS, were tweaked in order to get the best, improve the agreement between the not just circumferential strain, but the other, at least four of the five other strain components to the experimental measurements. So here we have the RMS error for circumferential strain, and the other strain components. We don't use radial strain because we feel that that is using fine tags and TTT, we don't have a great deal of confidence in the radial strain component, at least with the quality of the tagged images that we're able to acquire with the standard Siemens pulse sequence. So we don't even use that, and so the overall RMS error that these five, the cumulative five strain comparisons, circumferential strain, longitudinal strain, transverse shear in the radial circumferential plane, transverse shear in the radial longitudinal plane, and then the torsional circumferential longitudinal shear. Is this with a adding active stress only in the muscle fiber direction. And it turns out that we don't get a very good, at least we can greatly improve the agreement between predicted and measured longitudinal strain in particular if we add active stress in the cross fiber direction. We chose 40% because using biaxial testing, Frank Yin, using the same biaxial stretcher, in fact, subjected rabbit myocardium, thin sheets of rabbit myocardium, to a steady state contraction, kind of this. A model of end systole using barium contracture, and actually measured a development of active stress in the crossfiber direction that was about 40% of that in the muscle fiber direction. So these are the stresses grouped into the three different regions: remote, border zone, and aneurysm. This is fiber stress, in-plane cross-fiber stress, radial stress, and the shear stresses. And the most important thing when you're, as far as the surgeons are concerned, and what is the health of the border zone region, and what type of stimulus is this stress distribution going to, what type of remodeling is it going to give rise to? Most important thing is that the border zone, the stress in the border zone is significantly greater than that in the remote regions. So this, I know Alistair talked about the problems with the Batista procedure and Elliot talked about sudden cardiac death and electrophysiology. Alistair talked about this huge scar as a drawback of the Batista procedure. At least in Radcliffe's mind, a drawback of the Batista procedure, if the patient survives, is redilation. You remove the muscle, you make the chamber smaller, but in some patients, at least after a certain amount of time, the heart redilates. And if the stresses in the border zone near the operation are elevated, it's this probably is going to give rise to redilation. This is not a desirable stress distribution. So in conclusion, active cross-fiber stress development is an integral part of left ventricular systole. Finite element analysis with only uniaxial contraction is insufficient. Stress calculations from our validated models show 24% increase in fiber stress and 115% increase in cross-fiber stress in the border zone relative to remote regions. How am I doing for time?
Maybe a few more minutes.
Okay. Right, so I'll make, let me talk about the limitations. So here's an approach to determining material properties, estimating material properties from non-invasive measurements of 3D strain, at least, to measure left ventricular pressure. That is an invasive procedure. But Alistair has done a nice validation study using a silicon gel. So the theoretical basis or the general idea behind this approach has a good foundation or is sound. But this gel that Alistair's been using is not myocardial, it's not anisotropic. So it would be nice to perform some type of mechanical testing on regions, the same regions that have been, where material parts have been estimated from TAG MRI. And then on Monday, Leon talked about all of the complexities, particularly the endocardial and papillary muscles. So this is about as simple as you can get, a simple analysis as you can perform, and still have a fairly realistic model as far as, at least in comparison with three-dimensional strain from TAG to MRI. We didn't perform a formal optimization, what Alistair described with his determination of passive material properties of myocardium from TAG MRI and pressure measurements. That's something that we plan to do in the near future. And of course, we don't have a cardiac MRI specialist at the San Francisco VA. We have a vascular MRI expert, David Saloner, but we're not able to do the state-of-the-art scanning, for example. Many state-of-the-art techniques have been described at this nice workshop. So we're hoping in consultation with Dr. Axel that we can improve